Welcome to Fronteras, a Changing America. I'm your host, Vanessa Dalbovich. This week, we continue to focus on the Latino achievement gap in our region and explore how states are looking beyond federal guidelines and assistance to come up with some possible solutions to close the gap in the Southwest. More than one-third of Latino students are English language learners, and according to Department of Education data, they consistently perform poorly on state tests and have lower graduation rates than whites and Asians. Preschool works. There is a wealth of evidence that early education is key when it comes to narrowing the achievement gap between Latino children and their peers. But across the country and this region, access to quality, affordable preschool is lacking. Jude Joffe Block reports on a state-funded pre-K program in Nevada that is achieving results.
The pre-kindergarten classroom at Rundle Elementary in Las Vegas is stocked with books and toys. In the middle of the room, there's a colorful alphabet rug where four-year-old students sit cross-legged facing a teacher.
Read that with me, everybody. 11 people. What does that start with, everybody?
Almost all of the 24 students in the class are Latino. For many of them, English is their second language. Kindergarten is still several months away, and yet they're learning the basics of reading, writing, and counting syllables.
Let's do lion. Are you ready?
Lion.
How many parts was that?
Two.
Oh, Nevada's pre-K program is targeted to reach kids who are poised to do the worst in school. Here in Clark County, classes are placed in neighborhoods where family incomes are low and the number of English language learners, or ELLs, is high.
The ELL population, the low income families, the homeless population, those kids come in not playing the same game, really.
Kathleen Bannock is with the Clark County School District.
And that's what we want to get them all in the same game.
One way the program does that is by engaging parents. To even qualify for the program, parents must sign a pledge.
They have to report back the minutes per week that they're reading to their children. They have to also work on just engaging in play and high-quality time with mom or dad or a significant adult in their life. And they do have to report those minutes.
This pre-K class also addresses different levels of English among the kids.
Allí no va la foto.
There are four teachers in this classroom, and two are bilingual. They ease Spanish speakers into English instruction while still supporting their native language.
Esto vive en la basura.
Sí, en la basura.
The data shows this program is working to close the achievement gap. The state tracked kids up to sixth grade and found that English language learners who once enrolled in this pre-K outperformed the English language learners who didn't have pre-K. Parents also noticed the benefits. Yamisa Monreal has been surprised by how much her son Roberto has learned.
Ya sabe bastante y es muy seguro.
He's learned a lot, she says, and he's very confident. Monreal's only regret is that she didn't enroll her older daughter in pre-kindergarten when she was four. But despite these positive results, the state pre-K program is only big enough to serve around 1,300 kids, which is less than 2% of Nevada's four-year-olds. In fact, comparing state education data with U.S. Census estimates reveals that fewer than one-fifth of low-income kids in Nevada have access to any kind of public preschool, not counting special education. So many children are staying home or spending their days in childcare.
And that just makes absolutely no sense to me. It just boggles my mind.
Lucy Flores is a state legislator.
That knowing that we have something that works and it is so successful is actually not supported. And no one works to try to expand something that we know works.
But Nevada, like many other states, is broke. Even if pre-K is closing the achievement gap for Latino kids, there's no money to expand it. As a legislator, Flores plans to champion early education in the next legislative cycle, but she's well aware of the fiscal realities.
We're lucky that it's still in existence after all of the cuts that were made to education as a whole.
The even luckier ones are the nine states, including California, that won a federal grant to improve preschool. But several other states have scaled back. In Arizona, there were fewer slots in state-funded preschool this year compared to last year. Nationally, the percentage of Latino kids in preschool is declining, according to a UC Berkeley study. The authors found public programs can't keep up with demand, and parents can't afford private preschool. In Las Vegas, I'm Jude Joffe Block.
In Las Vegas, the heart of the Latino community is Rancho High School. That's why the school has become a campaign touchstone for politicians courting Hispanic voters. In fact, last presidential election, candidate Barack Obama visited Rancho not once, but twice. Yet nearly half of the Latino students who enroll at the school never finish. From the Fronteras desk, Ju Joffe Block visits a campus club that's trying to change things.
When class ends on Friday afternoon at Rancho High School, students cram the hallways, chatting and flirting in packs, celebrating the start of the weekend. The students from this neighborhood are mostly Latino and poor. 70% qualify for a free lunch. A quarter are learning English. A hall monitor yells in both English and Spanish to clear out. And most do, but one group of students stays. The Hispanic Student Union is always here meeting late on Fridays. There are some 50 students here out of about 2,000 Hispanic students at the school. Officially, the club is about community service and political activism. But perhaps more importantly, the club steers Latino students to leadership roles and higher education. Today's guest speaker is Roz Jimenez.
How many of you guys intend to graduate and go to college? I better see hands.
Most hands go up, but not all.
More hands. More hands.
Jimenez leads a sister chapter of the Hispanic Student Union at the local community college.
The graduation rates in Nevada, I mean, we're at the bottom, guys, okay, as a state. The Latino Hispanic community, the graduation rates for us is even lower.
Jimenez tells the students if they can make it to a local college, the Hispanic Student Union will be there to help.
We've been through what maybe you guys are going through right now.
They need to see these positive role models.
The Hispanic Student Union's faculty advisor is Isaac Barone. He has dark features and a black beard. Barone was raised in this neighborhood by Mexican immigrants. He made it through high school and college against the odds as a teenage father, which is why he takes his role very personally. He remembers one day when he chewed out a student for ditching class.
Then I did have one student. She asked, well, Mr. Barone, why do you care what he does? I mean, that's his time. And I care, I think, for this reason. Because whenever I see a young man or a young woman walk off, right, I see myself in them. And to me, as Latino, I feel that members in my community are closing off the future to themselves.
So Barone is doing what he can to change that. He's turned the Hispanic Student Union into a quasi-extended family.
We'll have the older students, you know, mentor the younger students. And we'll have the alumni. They always come back and they help out.
And those extra adults in the students' lives are important, especially for kids whose parents have limited education and English. And it seems to be working. Barone says students in the club graduate at much higher rates than the school's Latino students overall.
With the Hispanic teacher helping you, I feel like it helps you want to do more because that way, I don't know, it just like, oh, we could do it.
Edith Carrillo is a senior. She wasn't always serious about school. Then she became active in the club, and Barone began nagging about college.
Ever since, you know, oh, mija, because that's just what he always calls us.
That's Spanish for daughter.
Scholarships. Fill it out.
But many of Carrillo's peers never found that mentor or club to keep them on track. She has friends who got pregnant or got a job and dropped out. Those are the stereotypes that students in the club feel they have to overcome.
They underestimate us a lot. Just for the reason we're Hispanics.
Brenda Gomez is a senior in the club.
We can do something. We can change this world.
Alumni from the club are changing things and forging new paths. One is 31-year-old State Senator Ruben Kewin. He's running to be Nevada's first Latino congressman.
What's going on, Rancho?
Hispanic Student Union members are a core part of Kewin's campaign. They're walking neighborhoods and knocking on doors for him. To fire them up, Kewin shares his own story about how he went from their spot at Rancho to politics.
And you know, a lot of people said, you're not going to win because you're too young, because you were raised in the hood, okay, because you went to Rancho High School. Well, you could do two things. You could let that stuff put you down, or you can use it to inspire you.
In Las Vegas, I'm Jude Joffe Block.
New Mexico is becoming the latest state to be freed from the No Child Left Behind grading system. While the state may be free of the federal system, the recently implemented state A2F grading system left Las Cruces schools with less than stellar marks. Las Cruces Public Schools was a bit bottom-heavy with C's and D's, but Superintendent Stan Rounds says that isn't necessarily bad news. Last week, Rounds explained the new system and how Las Cruces falls into the educational spectrum. This week, we talk about just how far the grading system can push students without having an adverse effect. Glancing at these numbers, about half of them, around, you know, 50%, are D's or lower than that. It seems like we're at the bottom end of the spectrum. What are your thoughts on that?
You know, what we did, we think that given the statistical model that's being used and all the parts that we understand so far, Las Cruces should expect to look like a bell curve. So you should see the median grade at C. And so I would agree that we are below that expectation right now. And I wouldn't use the term greatly below, but slightly below, because I know about some schools that are what I'll call on the bubble as far as being within a couple of points of the next grade that would bring us closer to that standard deviation model that I would expect to see. Now, of course, we want to be better than that. And I would indicate that, number one, this is a simulation on a first set of data that we're still going to be studying pretty deeply. In fact, all of the information hasn't come to us yet. As we've broken down the data we do have, we know that the lowest quartile kids, the lowest performing kids, were actually doing an admirable job of increasing their learning, the pacing of their learning, faster, which is really what the requirement of making these grades higher is. So if you're a kiddo that's in my schools and you go to school for a year, we expect you to gain a year's worth of knowledge, right? That's what this model's built on. The model says if you do that with all your kiddos, that you're going to get a C. Now, because it has some components to it that really force that question, it's called value-added model. So it's how much value did he add in the current year, as well as how are you doing on the test in relationship with your peers. So it really does get into that issue. So it mediates. It gets to see if you go at the pace you should. Now, the way you get better than that is to learn more than you're supposed to learn in a year. And now remember, it's on a three-year average for a large part of this. And so in 3 years, you would expect to grow three grade levels. If you grow 2.5 grade levels, you get a D+. If you grow 3.5 grade levels, you get a B-. Okay?
Okay.
And so as we start looking across, you look at your lowest performers, that lowest quartile, the last group of kiddos, and we're really moving them faster than a year. In fact, doing it pretty dramatically in some cases in both reading and math. So that was good news to us, because under the old system of No Child Left Behind, that was a targeted group. And we learned how to really put resource and targeting into them. And I was very gratified to see that we grew them very well. We also in the district have been working at the upper 10% kids, the highest end kids, to be sure that those moving on to in that area are also not being forgotten, that we continue having that acceleration. And again, this early data looks really good, that we're moving out even more quickly with them too. So what that really then forms as our thesis question is, what happened to the rest of the kids? There's about 65% of the population that are the rest of the kids that moved along slower than they should have during that time. That's how you got a D. My suspicion is that if a student was approaching a year's worth of learning over a year and they weren't in those two target zones, we tended to figure that was okay. Now, that's not an excuse. In fact, that's, I think, a pretty good wake-up call for us, that you have to look at every child's progress and not become complacent because they're doing okay. We need to pray, I think in our system, we need to pressure ourselves to be more reliably focused on every student's momentum as well as their achievement.
So applying all of this in terms of the classroom, if you get what you should get done in a year, you still get a C or a D. You have to move beyond that to get higher marks. Is there a fine line between pushing students too far? Can you, you know, try to do too much and have the opposite effect?
That's always the balancing act, isn't it? And I think what it'll do forces this. As we're preparing kids for leaving our doors as seniors, what this is based on is the philosophy that they have to be ready and best abled to either step into the work world as a highly qualified worker or step into higher education or future post-secondary training and be highly competitive. I mean, that's really what this forces. So it means you want to exaggerate your growth above what you might normally have. So, but then the point is, do you overpress kids? I mm-hmm. hear that. I think that is that's always the system's question. And I did some things in the past. When I was over in Hobbs, when I was there, we were performing pretty high. And I had taken, for advanced placement classes, over 60% of my secondary kids were in advanced placement or pre-advanced placement. Generally, you get about 6% of the population there. And they told me, you can't do it. It's too much. And what we learned was you could do it if you put the parts in place that support kids so they're able to grow faster and reach that level of rigor. Because that's really what this is all about. So I think your question is right. Are you outdoing yourself? But the rest of the question is, what are you doing to support them as you pressure them up, as you push them to accelerate faster? And I'm not sure that's a bad thing based on my experience in Hobbs. Because you can do it, and it is attainable, and you can be pretty highly successful with it.
You mentioned the right kind of support. What do you think parents can contribute, or, you know, the community as a whole, to get these kids to that point?
Absolutely. Well, I think as a community as a whole, there are a couple of things that just spring to the front. And I'll be talking with you all more as we go through the rest of this year and into next year about some of these parts. But here's some things that I see that are important. Number one, we all have to throw our efforts behind tutoring and assisting kids as they're learning. Because all kids don't pace at the same rate, but the rigor is certainly going to be there. And so parents will need to be sure they stay engaged with their children. And when it gets beyond their ability, we have in place in the community the ability to reach out and bring others in as responsible adults to help out. And that's not just teachers, although teachers need to be doing the same thing, okay? But I can see a lot of our business. I talk to a lot of our business folks, a lot of other parents, and say, you know what? I don't mind having some time to do that kind of tutoring or assisting work with kids as they're doing it. I don't mind as a grandparent coming in at the elementary level and reading to children so they learn how to read better sooner and have the attack skills necessary. I like to do that. All of that kind of stuff. So it's a wake-up call for all of us to really get fully engaged with those kids. It means not giving children the buy card to say, I don't have anything I have to do tonight. I'm just going to go play or go mess around. I think we have to be sure kids get to school. And that's one of the victories in this. Do you know that our attendance rates competed very well? In fact, we got extra quality points because of our high attendance rates in most of our schools. You had to have at least a 95% attendance rate. Every school met that marker. And some were as high as 97%+.
So attendance was a factor in these scores. How did the graduation rate come into play?
Graduation rate still wasn't used in the metric that it will be. Okay. Nor, by the way, PSAT, SAT, and ACT scores will be part of more of this. What they did for high schools is they took one snapshot in MSBA 11th grade, and everything rose and fell on that, period, plus attendance. In the future design, it has these other parts we just talked about also in that.
Okay.
And that's going to be important. It's going to be the graduation rate increases and how it normalizes, and all, because that's all important stuff. It's just that in this first release, because remember, this isn't the full deal. This is a simulation to kind of give us a feel for where it's heading, to sort of test some things out. And this spring's testing will be the first real live fire testing. In fact, do you know they even went as far as last spring, the NMSBA test was re-metered, the cut points, they call them, that tells you whether a kid's proficient or not proficient and all that, puts the gradations in. were completely changed. Yet when they used the three-year database, they went back and interpolated statistically reverse into the data to get it to simulate what the growth apparently was with these kids. So it's not even real data. It's kind of statistically adjusted data, okay, which as a statistician kind of a guy, I don't object to. But it's not real live fire yet. So again, that's I'm not using it as an excuse, and don't hear that, because I think it's pretty good. It's just it isn't really everything on deck yet, and it will be next year. So that could change some things, because it could change as many as 8 or 10 points in people's ratings, up or down, by the way. But I'm really having to dig into this and get my head wrapped around it. I was on the superintendent's committee of advisors to the secretary on this, and I want to publicly thank her for taking our input and implementing a number of issues that we asked be put into this.
You can find more information on the new state grading system by visiting the Public Education Department website, ped.state.nm.us. I'm Vanessa Dalbovich. Thanks for tuning into Fronteras, a Changing America.